the prospect of an Asian Renaissance towards a theory of the ancient. Quoting Paul Valéry's The European, "Wherever the European mind prevails, there we witness the maximum of needs, the maximum of labour, capital and production, the maximum of ambition and power, the maximum transformation of external nature, the maximum of relations and exchanges. All these taken together are Europe, or the image of Europe. Moreover, the source of this development, this astonishing superiority, is obviously the quality of the individual man, the average quality of Homo Europaeus. It is remarkable that the European is defined not by race or language or customs, but by his aims and the amplitude of his will." It's an open secret among experts that for more than 100 years now, a large part of Western intelligence has been Asianizing, as they say. Therein, one could perceive an ironic game that an object of cognition plays with its subject. In the world of intelligences, the discoverer is always exposed to a counter-discovery by those who have been discovered. For the bourgeois world between the 17th and 19th centuries, the interest in the East began under the sign of colonialism, which soon brought about an intellectual world trade. It was through the generation of early romantics that Asian imports were first brought to a theoretical level and incorporated into a generous synopsis of world cultures. A world conversation about world literature is what the cheerful mission statement of a romantic ecumenism proclaimed, in which Persian poetry and translations of the Upanishads were passed around as evidence of the actually metaphysical activity of the world soul. But it did not end with philological flirtation, for the actual East, being discovered by another spirit, turned out to be a date with destiny. What first began as discovery and then turned into conquest, mission and instruction of the East soon pulled the old East into the mobilization of the planet along with it. Japan has given the world a model for self-liquidation in its final form, committing a seppuku for the sake of industry and history that will remain forever astonishing. Old Asia probably disappeared from the earth one day in the course of an epochal self-colonization, only surviving in the libraries of Western-inspired Indology, Sinology, Japanology, not unlike the way old Europe has only survived in classical philology, medieval seminars and period dramas. This process must be formulated in an exaggerated way in order to correctly assess the West Asian cult and all its strangeness. As the real East throws itself into industrial, scientific, political, and military mobilization in order to leave its old ways of thinking and being behind, the West is experiencing a cultural Asianizing for which there is no historical precedent. Unless one wanted to accept the pervasion of the Roman Empire by Greco-Hellenic curricula as an analogue. In this case, one would have to cite the cynical motif of conquering the conqueror, Horace's Graecia capta ferocem victorem vincit, is still on the tip of the last humanist's tongues. After all, the verse, "Conquered Greece took prisoner her rough conqueror," proves how conspicuous it was, even in a Roman setting, to have a victor bow to the superiority of the vanquished. Nevertheless, the topos of conquering the conqueror is not suitable for deciphering the inflation of Asianizing motifs in the current Western cultural scene. If we look through the historical arsenal for a prototype for current events, the only phenomenon that lives up to the Occidental enthusiasm for Asia is that of a cultural renaissance. We will argue in a moment that the phenomenon of our Great Renaissance, which occurred at the end of the Middle Ages, can probably only be understood in light of today's Asia cult. Renaissances are visualizations of old culture in a new context. A Renaissance shows its genius in finding the ability to step into something entirely unprecedented under the cover of its enthusiasm for a prominent antiquity. The unprecedented newness can emerge precisely by drawing inspiration from a great precedent. It seems as if enthusiastic repetitions are the great vehicle of innovation. In this way, Renaissances always owe their profligacy to a passionate misunderstanding of the old by a newness that does not yet speak its name. Only through an intense misrecognition do antiquities get brought back to a new life, one that is not their own, but rather the fluorescence of the still necessarily self-misrecognizing current life. What the Greco-mania of the Italian Renaissance, and then again of the late 18th and 19th centuries, meant for the self-forming of modern bourgeois society is by now culturo-historically evident. But what it might have to do with a more recent Asia mania is still an unrevealed secret for most contemporaries. Many come to take this, certainly conspicuous phenomenon, to be a fashion trend or an episodic exoticism. Thus, it would seem they make good use of their fundamental right to live in ignorance of the major events of their time. But this does not change the fact that things are being negotiated in the Asia-manic phenomena of the present time, which get to the heart of the world process, insofar as we are able to know something about it. When the West imagines itself to be in a sunken East, and channels Asian antiquity as a master model of culture for life in the present, it is searching for possibilities of a future for itself within a foreign past. Nothing other than this was precisely the case back in the great European Renaissance, which rarely suspected the profound differences that separated it from its ancient Greek models. Today's Asianizing Renaissance similarly delves deep into old Eastern worlds of wisdom to create pathways towards the new, the unprecedented, the inaccessible for late modernity, whose corruption seems threatening, if not entirely incurable. For many, Asia is the cipher that offers shelter to a concept of the inconceivable. Initially, we can draw four conclusions from this. The first is that a post-Christian era has begun within the Western Hemisphere that could not possibly find the terms it would require to understand itself within the scriptures of the Judeo-Christian tradition. Following in the footsteps of the young Hegelian Bruno Bauer, the young conservative diagnostician Otto Petras already summarized the situation in 1935 in the form of a still impressive intention, quote, "to show that Christianity, the most formidable history-shaping movement of our time, has exhausted its formative power, and that we live in a post-Christianity understood in a deeper sense than the calendars AD," end quote. Secondly, modernity, thus left to its own devices, at least according to the conviction of sceptical interpreters, has used up its moral reserves and has no counterforces to deploy that could intercept its own fatal drift. Enlightened secularism, with its dual commitment to self-determination and large-scale technology, is disappearing, it seems, before our very eyes in global neglect. Things run as they please, and initial intentions are no longer of concern. Thirdly, the attempts of the last Central European generations to invoke livable forms of neo-paganism from Germanic, Celtic, Greek, and Latin religious antiquities have proved to be straw fires that sometimes burned off with barbaric fumes, and rarely on a level higher than that of spiritual party conversations. Thus, anyone who is interested likely knows that under present conditions, one might perhaps make a rural commune with that homemade raw substance of old European and pre-Christian elements, but no longer a territorial state. Fourth, a turn to the east. For Americans, it is not a turn anyway, but a continuation of their old western course, only through water. Brings into play no less than a world cultural alternative to the Greco-Judeo-Christian path that retains its quality as alternatives, even when the actual contemporary Eastern Hemisphere modernizes itself beyond recognition by adopting Western mobilization techniques. What does it indicate that in the crisis of late modern Western world, this phenomenon, here referred to as an Asian Renaissance, is interlaced with it? If a logic of the Renaissance really exists, then the new Asia Mania should be read as a sign that creative members of post-Christian civilization hope to come to an understanding of themselves by grasping at antiquity once again. But this time, not so that it can be appropriated as one's own antiquity, but as antiquity in a foreign form. This time the illusion of a memory of something that once belonged to us is not being sought. Today an Asian antiquity rising to the rank of exemplarity? Today an Asian antiquity rising to the rank of exemplarity? Exemplarity? What a baffling word. Anyway, has to do not with what is foreign or one's own, but with the very spirit of the ancient as such. In other words, we have become so uncanny to ourselves through our modernization that the old strange sounds of the Far East suddenly begin to sound like an old familiar idiom. And although it is obviously not a native language that touches us so suggestively in this respect, it could, after many twists and turns, become a sister language to our mother tongue. To put it differently, once again, the destruction of our own traditions by way of modern analytics has stripped our lives down to the stumps. That is, all the way down to the anonymous awareness of the fact that we find ourselves in a world that is both foreign and our own at the same time. This design-making awareness that is thrown into being can now learn the language of Buddha, as well as that of Plato, in order to clarify its strange position to itself, insofar as it experiences every language as a foreign one. From now on, it only knows itself as that which cannot know itself and cannot name itself. And if it can, then only in the form of a persistent self-misrecognizing, of an essential theatricality. From the anonymousness of this existence, the path to Lao Tzu or Chuang Tzu is no longer than the path to Parmenides or Augustine, the path to Plotinus and Hegel, no steeper than one to Nagarjuna and Shankara, the path through Aristotle no drier than the one through Patanjali, the entry into the way of being of Meister Eckhart no more mysterious than that of Master Dogen. Whether of Eastern or Western origin, the same exhausting improbability looms over these old names and doctrines, the same fascinating strangeness. Precisely because modernization has evaporated our old European traditions and identities by way of progressive mobilization, the most foreign ancient tradition is no longer more foreign than the one that has, until recently, been our own. It is in this context that the punchline of the Asian Renaissance in the modern West becomes clear. It makes us so pointedly aware of the question of the ancient preconditions of the modern enterprise that while we can underestimate, misunderstand, combat, and disregard it, we can in the end no longer shake it off. As long as these times remain modern, they will be haunted by the question of the compatibility of human life processes and modernity itself. Since human culture is demonstrably very old and modernity very new and unsubstantiated, it is not a secondary task to find out if modernity is an outdoing of the ancient by the means of the modern, or if its modernity puts a final end to antiquity. This question has become so urgent that the difference between the familiar and the foreign no longer plays any major role in these matters, since the most foreign traditions are no longer more foreign to us than our own. It becomes clear how much our path towards the unparalleled has put all of the old world nature and culture reserves up for negotiation. Because it is by now undeniable that a universalizing modernity exists in the form of mobilization as such. The question of antiquity as such, it pushes itself to the forefront almost violently. Well then, what is it that we take with us from antiquity on our trip into the unprecedented? Which dowries from the ancient world still create a link between past and future? What provisions will future generations live on during their continued exodus? How do the vessels in modern outer space stay in contact with the ancient ground controls? These very questions indicate that the Asianizing Renaissance goes far beyond the events of the Grecicizing Renaissance in the early bourgeois mobilization time. It is both more than and different from a mere cultural quote that will unleash something unprecedented in allusion to an authentic antiquity. Because it already emerges after this unleashing, and already has an impression of what modernity can be. It poses the question more radically than the Renaissance of the 15th and 16th centuries, and seeks the ancient as something that is not just a pretext for the modern. Since the world belongs to the moderns anyway, the moment has come to inquire about the possibility of the ancient as ancient. Modern Asiamania is a renaissance to the extent that it sides with those antiquities, whether ancient culture or nature, that create conditions for new world adventures. Thus, the new Asiamanically encrypted renaissance as such asserts the authority of the ancient in two ways. On the one hand, it stresses that modernity would not exist if it could not, as user and consumer of pre-modern resources, depend on that which it, in an ultimately self-destructive way, exploits without regenerating. On the other hand, it proves that the new world enterprise fundamentally overwhelms the ancient precepts, since modernity follows the drive to carry out an infinite project on a finite basis. It obeys this drive if it has constituted itself metaphysically as beings towards movement. This is actualized through us in the production of expanded productivity, in the will to a further reaching will, in the imagining of heightened imagination, in the creation of more comprehensive creativity. In short, in the movement towards movement ad infinitum. As being towards movement, modernity is defined as mobilization as such, in other words, as being towards self-annihilation. The renaissance as such that we see at work in the Asianizing activity of the more sensible West equals nothing less than an ontological sign change. For if there is a common denominator for the currents of ancient Asian thought, it is that they grasp the meaning of being as a being towards stillness within movement. Even where, as in yoga, One works with the highest mobilizations of forces in the sense of a mystical physiology. The focus of consciousness is always on the advancement towards stillness within strength. The focus of consciousness is always on the advancement towards stillness within strength. The Asianizing tendencies in the West are perhaps only awkward, tentative attempts in this direction. They express the intuition that nothing less than an ontological sign change will suffice to take the fatal thrust out of the process of modernization. Nowadays, whoever looks for a language of demobilization will most likely find it in the ancient Eastern realm, where dramatic dramaturgies have been developed for the kinetics of the will to live, than in the Western mobilization civilization. Where different dramaturgies have been developed for the kinetics of the will to live than in the Western mobilization civilization. And it is only by borrowing from such languages, which irritate us with their frustrating wisdom, that it is possible to point, however awkwardly, to what needs to be said in the midst of the worldwide movement towards movement. The unthinkable impertinence that is heard by modern ears in old Asian quietism, quietest keys, is aimed at the kinetic demission of mobilizing systems and subjects. But can we seriously imagine our de-automobilization? Can we conceive of a way of being where the system subjects would no longer be driven forward by their self-advancement propellers? Does a prospect even exist for us where the powers of the subject generate something other than otherworldly exhilaration, enrichment, research, and empowerment? These questions do not comprise disclaimers for modernity after the fact owing to bad experiences with it. They are as old as modernity itself. Indeed, they are inseparable from the superb upswing of early Romanticism, in which an offensive modernism, sustained by the elan of self-outdoing, inquired beyond itself in its best philosophical moments. Novalis's phrase, quote, "One is greatly in error if one believes that antiquities exist, antiquity is only now coming into being," end quote, already holds the key to the postmodern renaissances. What emerges out of the new antiquities are shadows that belong to the light of modernity. The more modern, the more postmodern, there is no way around this formula. Aside from an imperceptible boundary, nothing can survive the impulse of modern self-mobilization ad infinitum, unchanged, unless it be through the boundless generosity of postmodern patronage for the benefit of Renaissances as such.